Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Discussing Runaway Cyclone by Jagadish Chandra Bose. This time it's a really special one because I'm joined by my two lovely housemates. Their names are
Gabriel
and Kai.
And we have a very professional setup going on right now. State-of-the-art surround sound systems. Mm-hmm. We're not using one mic and just bunched up really close together.
It's not what's happening.
The most high-tech mics
mm-hmm.
and laptops
mm-hmm.
we're using for this.
Only the best here.
We went to a studio, in fact.
This is green screen.
We rented a studio for this.
So I really wanted to talk to you guys. And actually, I was really excited. And everybody else I've talked to about this project was excited about this kind of conversation between, you know, non-physicists or non-like people who are academically trained in the sciences. But I thought it is interesting because this is a story about, before we get into it, sorry, any general thoughts on the story, honest feedback?
General thoughts on the story?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was very funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's really funny. There are a few instances where I said it's just humorous shit right here. And I didn't expect it to be that funny.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that. It was interesting. Obviously, the ending is potentially funny. I didn't read it as funny. But in the context, I guess it's quite funny.
I liked it, generally. It surprised me a lot. I didn't know where I was being taken. I was confused for most of the time. But it was a good confusion. The confusion was a tool. So the more confused that I was, the funnier it would get later on.
That's true. We talked about this before, and you did say the specific passage that confused you was interesting. It's when the German scientist is talking about gravity. And he goes on this long tirade about how gravity, you know, is bounding heavier mass and is dependent on these structures. But at the end of it, he just confuses the audience and possibly his intended readers in the story
mm-hmm.
because he just goes on this intellectual tirade without actually addressing the problem.
Yeah, I thought that was humorous to me, that part. That was one of the funny parts, I thought.
That was the funniest to me.
So do you guys see that as Bose trying to, in some ways, critique that kind of Western intellect?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just the classists.
I found it funny.
Mm.
I just like the general sort of overextension of knowledge to no benefit. So much so that it completely lost sight of the actual problem.
Right.
And the solution to that problem.
Yeah, just that part becomes more political, or it's just guys being smart.
Hmm. Right, so that's interesting where you said not Western but classism.
Yeah.
Right, do you mind just going into a little bit? Because I do find that distinction interesting.
Certain academic class.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
These guys that have been in school and have all this knowledge, so now they have to show it to everyone.
Right.
They have to put it to use
one way or
another, even though it's absolutely not the subject. They need to put it somewhere.
So he's kind of like massaging his intellectual ego.
Yes.
Right. And so there's this divorce that, you know, especially in physics, that we have, where you do have these intellectuals or other people with in positions of high integrity that don't kind of understand the issues. And I think we can look at what's happening in the current global climate crisis at the moment
mm-hmm.
and see that we don't have, you know, effective leadership in a lot of ways. So it's interesting that the solution that comes to the sannyasi, right?
Mm-hmm.
The invention always really interesting because he dreams of it. And we see this idea of dream-like behavior being negated in like maybe more class-based kind of intellectualism where, you know, if it comes to you in a dream, it's not rational thought, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you guys interpret that kind of, would you say subversion of a scientific narrative? Or just a moral kind of respectful way of, you know, talking about cultural knowledge?
In terms of the dreams?
Yeah.
I don't know that it's subversion
mm-hmm.
of... So I feel like dreams and weird dreams and like fantasy dreams are part of science fiction. I'm trying to remember in what context the dream was spoken about.
It's the sannyasi when the British sahib comes to him.
Yeah. So is that in a dream? Is that interaction the dream? That's the dream.
The dream is the invention of the hail as a solution for okay. the lion's balding.
For the problem.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. What I always thought was interesting of that is then this dream, this thing, this sort of like holistic medical practice, whatever that's been developed, is then now something commercialized and sold.
Right.
You know, bottled up, and is now freely available for anyone to purchase.
Mm.
And I thought that was interesting because I wasn't sure what comment the author was making on that point.
With the commercialization aspect.
Yeah.
Right. So that's where I think people would say that this is just an ad for a hair oil, right?
Yeah.
Where he's just, obviously it's a scientific competition. He's just trying to get popular and trying to probably make some money and get that bag.
Mm.
But would it be reductionist to say that that's all the hair oil is doing?
Yeah.
I feel like there's too much
there's
just
more.
Limit to that.
Yeah. There's mm-hmm. way more. And like that's like we were talking about earlier. It's irrelevant whether he was getting the bag or not. You know, you got to do what you got to do. How he chose to write it and structure it around this hair oil and the whole sort of sci-fi cyclone plot that, you know, it's cataclysmic. Like it's huge.
Mm.
You know, it's going to destroy the whole city.
Mm.
And like interplaying it with all like sort of satirical takes on, you know, Western scientific discourse, you know, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely not just, you know, for the Pete. It's like there's a lot more to it.
Not something mythologically big like that.
Right. So this we talked about this two days ago. Between Kai, we're talking about traditional medicine and the idea of witchcraft. And you said something interesting where when we first met, you know, I thought you identified as a witch, but then when we had the conversations prior, you said that witchcraft isn't really, it doesn't mean anything definite.
It can mean absolutely anything depending on who says it at what time. So magic or witchcraft, like for some people, it's just going to be science. And for some people, it's just going to be the devil, depending on their religion. It's just going to be jinns.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on who says it when, it just doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
People use the word witch or witchcraft because they know that people who hear them are going to get pretty much the point.
Some idea of what it is.
Because they're most of the time no better word, or if there's a better word, they don't know if other people are going to understand it
mm-hmm.
because it's going to be too precise.
Mm-hmm.
Or not known enough, so they just say witch or witchcraft because it's faster and it's easier.
And how much of that connotation of witchcraft do you think acts as like an opposite of science? You know, like if it's witchcraft, it's not based in scientific thought or rationale, you know, as a way of like discrediting the art of practicing as a source of witchcraft.
Science, science is not witchcraft when it's documented, for one, and when it's shared, because witchcraft tend to be
more intimate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because it tend to be from cultures, families, stuff like that.
Mm.
So science is more general. Witchcraft also most of the time is made to help people.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, like when science, so medicine and stuff like that, is not affordable for poor communities, then witchcraft is going to take the job.
Right, as this kind of grassroots self-empowerment kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Just to survive most of our time, just to help the people of the village.
That's really interesting because it goes back to the point we were talking about earlier where the scientist isn't talking to something relevant about the community, but you said witchcraft is for helping people, essentially. So there's this divorce. So you're saying that the divorce is between what's useful for a community and what's not, is what science and witchcraft can be at times.
Mm.
That's really interesting. And I think that's the interesting thing also about how we talk about science and spiritualism in that whole debate, where here, obviously, we can talk about this story as science and spiritualism, and how he's using an Indian, you know, quote unquote yogi to displace spiritualism and combat the art of, like, not art, but the machinations of Western science.
Mm-hmm.
But I think sometimes that debate is difficult and reductionist because it's just binary. Yeah, because, like, it's not like Europe didn't have
of course,
right?
No, I think it's like dangerous binary to look at science and I don't know what is considered to be the antithesis in terms of all sorts of, you know, bases and structures, be that like, I don't know, witchcraft or like spirituality, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, those things coexisted for like centuries before, you know, the Enlightenment.
Hardly sometimes.
The Enlightenment ruined it all, ruined everything for everyone. You know, those things were more interchangeable, you know, mm-hmm. and not just interchangeable, but supported each other, you know, developed because of each other. Like you've told me a few times about, you know, the story about the Baghdad House of Wisdom,
mm-hmm.
and like how they established that, like how they chose to build it and who they chose to, you know, talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a melding of all sorts of sort of, whether it be spiritual, you know, astrology,
mm.
Which is another thing that comes into that sort of aspect of like the antithesis to what would be a rational European sort of scientific attitude.
All the shit.
Sort of dominated it post Enlightenment and created that binary more and reinforced it.
Right. Just for our listeners, I think the House of Baghdad, the invention of actual construction of it, the Sultan consulted three specialists, and one of them was an astrologer, to whom he asked, "What is the most auspicious day to start laying the first brick of the city?" So there's this document of a Sultan of a big empire asking an astrologer for his opinion and validating and showing the validity of what we would now call pseudoscience, right? So it's very interesting, like you said, that there's, you would say the Enlightenment era is where it became this divorce thing, because we even have like,
my opinion doesn't really count for
it. No, your opinion is why you're here. Your voice matters. And so in that sense, when we think about like even Newton or Einstein or Michael Faraday, who was also a physicist, all of them practiced religion to some extent. And Newton practiced religion very heavily. I have this quote here, talking about gravity. He said that with respect to his work, God designs along rational and universal principles. So saying that, you know, scientists can explain why certain celestial objects move in the way they do, how they do it, but not why, right? And so he needed his Christian beliefs to, you know, give that answer to why. And in a lot of ways, that kind of history for Newton has been erased, which I can imagine comes from that rational thought that was conceptualized in the Enlightenment movement.
For sure. Yeah. And even like, you know, and all that comes with the Enlightenment in the sort of slow, you know, atheism and, you know, bashing everyone now, bashing the atheists.
I can bash the atheists. It's fine.
Okay.
Like,
but like, you know, that was, atheism is a conclusion of that rational thinking, born in, like, crystallized, I guess, by the Enlightenment, you know, not as opposed to born in the, like, obviously there were those ways of thinking prior to that, but
right.
The way it became dominant through the Enlightenment, I lost my train of thought.
I think that's perfectly fine. Like, it's always hard to find the origin, and this is something I've been learning a lot more as I do history of science, is that originist theory is just, it's not useful for anybody because you kind of singularize a cultural zeitgeist, right?
Yeah, stuff that's so complex.
Right.
It develops over, like, in unquantifiable way, like ways we can't quantify.
Right. And that's kind of the thing where objectivity comes into play and quantifiable measurement, where I've been doing a lot of research on eugenics, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Anita. So far. But the interesting thing about the eugenicists, a lot of whom were statisticians and mathematicians, is that they didn't believe that they operated with any ounce of personal prejudice, whether it be religious, spiritual, or, you know, ethnic prejudice. They believe they operated on a basis of complete and complete objectivity. Mm. And yet they were still able to say things like, you know,
black people are made into submission naturally.
Yes.
Stuff like that.
Yes, like
good old Aristotle.
Is that Aristotle? Right.
I think so.
So
yeah.
There's a very famous statistician called the father of modern statistics, Pearson. And he literally said that if you put, you know, a black person next to a white person in society, eventually the roles of master and slave would come through. But these are people who say they're operating on objectivity. So
yeah.
Now we've come to a culture where we can't question anything physics or scientific fields.
Yeah, objectivity is a myth.
It's a myth.
Yeah.
Say it louder. It's a myth.
It's a myth, you know. And that's what stories like that get to play with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it gets to play with the idea that, you know, hair oil will stop a fucking huge cyclone. You know,
you can say.
You know, it will stop a cyclone. And those are the sorts of persistencies that are, you know, and that's not fiction. Like, okay, the idea of that's fiction, but the possibility of it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
If you know what I mean.
I think it's understandable that there's methods of knowledge that are just not so based in rationality.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Like, intuitive, emotional, I mean, like, all the mystics and, like, Europe during that, you know, that was all based on their knowledge and understanding. It was all based on sort of affective and like love, like people that received visions, you know. Hildegard of Bingen, she was a scientist, like,
mm-hmm.
She was like medical, she was a doctor, but she had visions of like fucking flaming carnitas with like three heads and, you know, like all this crazy stuff that was just as real.
What's a carnitas?
For Hildegard, it's like truth, you know, I think. Or body, I don't know. Basically, caritas. I don't know. It's like sort of one of her godlike sort of
Simple.
Creations.
Okay.
And she was a doctor. She wrote extensive medical reports and stuff like this.
Mm.
Like, that she was a fucking composer, you know. And all of these things were intertwined.
Mm.
They weren't like... And that comes with her being a prioress of an abbey in Germany.
So there's so many multitudes existing within this one
person.
And it's okay that they can exist and not have to justify how they can exist with each other. I think sometimes we have to, like, if I'm a scientist, I have to justify my religion all the time with it, right?
Like, nowadays, it's not even justified or stuff like that. Nowadays, it's just looked down upon from the smart people.
Mm.
Like, what was his name? Stephen Hawking?
Yeah, Stephen Hawking.
The one who just, like, spat on God. Like, they were just people, smart people nowadays, educated people. They just spit on religions and they just look down on it. And they just see it as a need for religious people to, like, not be too scared of death.
Okay.
And they limit it at that. And they just... It's that high esteem of themselves that has got them, just like it got... previous generations to make mistakes, like those stupid eugenics, and thinking that they did stuff and not being able to be wrong about it,
right?
Because they were so sure of it. Like, at the end of it, all of that is just because of the high esteem these guys had for themselves.
Yeah, and I think they were, you're right, because they were backed by, you know, well, the history is kind of different for eugenics. Initially, this guy called Galton in Britain tried to bring about eugenics, but he didn't get much support. But after 20, 30 years, he found a lot of purchase and government support and support from universities. He was based in UCL. but
shout out. Well, that's a...
I think we can kind of divert from religion, spiritualism and science a little bit, and talk about the broader context of things, because what I find interesting is the kind of complete reinvention of, like, original thought when it comes to these kind of things. Like, sometimes we can think that we're, you know, the first people to talk about colonialism and sci-fi in a subversive way, or these kind of things, but this story was written more than 100 years ago, right? Nearly 150 years ago. And there's also another, writer, Rokeya Begum, who is also Bengali. She's considered the first female woman sci-fi writer in the Bengal region. And she wrote this story called Rukaya, Sultana's Dream. And it was a story about a feminist utopia, as you would call it now. And in the story, all the men kind of just don't exist in any pivotal or powerful roles. And the utopia then takes a shape in which society is thriving. And this is 1905. This is the same year that Einstein published Special Relativity. Do you know what I mean? Like, these are ideas from 100 years ago that would now still seem subversive.
Mm-hmm.
But people were, like, on it back in the day. Sometimes when you talk about how people might have been, you know, skeptics of, like, religion and science existing together or whatever, I think sometimes it helps to look back on these kind of things and understand that people were radicals, you know,
yeah,
and existing against, what would you want to say, a colonial or Western or just classist constructs?
Yeah. For that context, yeah, those, but any sorts of power. I mean, you know, people have been radicals since there's been people. Not like to reduce this at all. I'm just saying, you know, like, this is just another great example of that fact.
We were talking about that yesterday, I think, about how, like, people give the excuse of their generation or their time to excuse, like, their racism or their mistakes or stuff like that.
Mm.
But it's just not true.
Mm.
In the end, it's just an easy excuse.
Mm.
Because through any time at all, any generation, like, there were always people who knew what was wrong and what was right.
Mm-hmm.
There were always, like, people that didn't want slaves to be a thing. People
mm-hmm.
that understood that women were equals, that all races and religions were equals,
mm-hmm.
that eugenics were stupid.
Right. And I think in that sense, it's sad because even people like Jagadish Chandra Bose, they came from middle upper class societies in,
mm-hmm.
you know, back in the day, India. And so there is this lower class of people who were great thinkers, obviously, who aren't recorded. And so we don't know what they thought. We do, even though radical voices that we do get are from a very privileged position in that sense.
But we prefer to keep on talking about fucking Aristotle, Freud.
Yeah.
Again and again.
Yeah. I mean, you get the same problems with in the medieval as well, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, even I just purely in sources and what you were talking about, like,
mm-hmm.
work from the voiceless, because, you know, there's a reason they're voiceless.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, that doesn't mean they didn't exist or think
mm-hmm.
in those ways and did not enforce radical, you know, whether it be anti-colonial ways of existing or, you know, going way back, you know, just fighting against any sort of power structure, you know, if you're the serfs, then any sort of, you know, your feudal lords or whatever, you know, always existed.
What is, in your perspective, from studying history for 3 years, how would you say you could be more ethical in the way that you source, just as a, if you have any ideas or opinions?
How could anyone be more ethical?
In their sources or...
Well, it's just all... You just always have to remember you're just reading someone else's... There are no sources. Unless, like, you're... Like... You know, reading verbatim what... you know, someone is saying. But even then, sources are presented in a way in collections.
Mm-hmm.
I guess less now with the internet. It's probably more access to sort of... Even then, it's like... I don't know, always be looking for, like, all types of voices on any given sort of field of interest, you know, and don't be sticking to the same old sort of popular generic white historians that, you know, trudge fucking terrible dangerous narratives about history. And there's so much, like, there's honestly, like, so much academic work out there that's good, but then there's also so much shit.
Well,
and sometimes you don't know that you just have to read and, like, and just trust that you can see the difference.
Right. Yeah.
Hope.
Well, that is, I think, hope is such a, you know, not to make it sound cheesy, but that in that way it's very political because, like, when we started reading History of Science, the first person we read was this dude called George Basala, and he talks about colonial science and colonial activity, but in the way that when colonialism expands, it introduces a lot of new science to the colonies, the practicing of that colonial science that benefits that community. And so when reading him, he does argue for contextual understanding of science, that, you know, if you're operating in a certain context, it breeds a certain kind of science. but there's no negative connotation with what happens to the colonized people's original culture or their methods of, you could say, scientific inquiry, but science is obviously invented in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Like in East Asia, they had a different terminology completely for science, you know, at that time. So there is this interesting aspect of considering locality, but again, the sources that come through are the sources that can be very general and opaque. So you do have to kind of just hope that, okay, reading Basala gave me hope that people can think of science in contextual ways, but I knew that wasn't the end point. Like, there has to be more than this. And then I read this person called Raj Kapil who opened my eyes on a lot of other things, but it is this kind of, I guess you could say, a more maybe linear progression of developing more kind of hope and solidarity with sources that are not just the most popular ones and that can seem like the only ones that exist. So I wanted to ask also how, talking to Kai for the audio listeners, your journey of kind of, you could say, decolonization, like reading textbooks or going on TikTok, what is...
Started in school. I quit high school for the last year just so I could like study by myself and learn stuff by myself. So that's when I started learning properly. That's when I started learning several languages and actually connecting with people and realizing that school was absolute utter shit.
Hear that?
So I started doing research. Started talking to people, started working on the fact that no source will ever be 100% sure or reliable. That's mostly hard. It's hard. There's a lot of stuff that I would like to learn, but either I don't have the specific language to learn it yet, or it's just the knowledge is gone. It's impossible to find. Either it's kept in some school somewhere in the US or in Russia or wherever, or it's just, it was quashed.
Or the British Library.
Yeah.
The archives, they got such dark shit in there for sure.
So it's just really hard to find. Like, I'm a person that constantly look for knowledge, and especially the right kind. So a knowledge that would not be white-centered, Euro-centered, stuff like that. And as soon as you get off from these rails, it becomes super hard and it becomes a battle. So I'm still working with that. So right now, all I got is going very deep on internet. That's all I do. Like, thank God, like, for students that would have to work for something, for a dissertation or stuff like that. We were talking about that the other day. Like, in the end, these guys, they don't have the time that I have to look for the proper sources. To go like dig for the proper sources. So in the end, most of the time, they're gonna have to like take what's there, what's easy to find, and that's gonna be the white European stuff.
Right.
And they mostly don't have a choice because they don't have the time or the energy because they're all packed with their studies.
Right.
So it's a battle that they cannot fight.
It's interesting that kind of cycle of losing, especially in university, where you're there for 3 years, right? And any work that people do is so temporal that it kind of loses itself. Like, I was talking to people in Oxford, some Oxford students, and we talked about a person called Alolu Femi, who was a black, I think British student who was in the English department. They had become, they had been gaslighted by the English department in Oxford University because they proposed for a wider sources of reading literature instead of just white cis men. And I think one of the major publications, like Guardian or Telegraph, like posted a picture of her and saying something like, students want to destroy the English curriculum, right? Just for asking for a simple...
Yeah, I think that was like the year before I went to uni.
Right, and so this person, who's I think in the second or third year, didn't even hear of them, and they were working on decolonization projects. And that was interesting, right? Because it's like this temporal loss of knowledge is just university propagates.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it is, like you said, students are made and encumbered. So the system is designed in such a way in which you can't question. I agree with that quite a lot. And so that's why, like, stories like these are so important to read. And I know, like, everybody I've talked to is interesting because everybody has got kind of the same reaction. Where it's like, I had to read it twice.
Yeah. I had to read it twice.
Everybody said that because the first time people read it, the first time I read it, I was like, oh, it's an interesting story.
Like, it starts with such big words and stuff like that. It's just...
Yeah, and then sometimes it progresses into a kind of queer direction, and you're just like, okay, this is something he just wrote for his kids, read them as a bedtime story. But we talked about this earlier with Gabe, that he came back to it 40 years later, and this is something we discussed on the podcast previously with Dr. Sonia, that he comes back to it 40 years later,
yeah,
right? There is something being very monumental being said there in that sense, right?
Yeah.
For a herald.
For a herald. Kuntal Qureshi, yes. Is that a moment's pronunciation?
And it's so original, it's so puzzling. Like I told you the other day, it's like I would write a story about saving the earth from, like, I don't know, healing the coral with a Lush bath bomb.
Yeah, I remember. That was kind of perfect.
Yeah, that is probably the
modern day. And it's like, no one is going to think about doing something like that because it's so crazy. So it's going to grab your attention so hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's going to make you ask many questions that I still don't have the answer to, most of them.
It's just great hair oil.
It is great hair oil. Awesome. Any other thoughts that you want to express or just, you know, want people to consider in the general context of sci-fi writing literature?
It was nice. Right now I'm trying to get this kind of things, stuff. I feel like we're missing stuff like that nowadays,
mm-hmm.
like this fairy tale kind of thing.
Mm.
This like big adventure,
mm.
stuff like that.
We need to bring the medieval back.
Please.
What does that mean?
Please.
Huh?
What does that mean, bring the medieval back?
It means we're nerds. It
means community.
Okay.
It means... no borders.
Okay.
It means love for all. And it means fucking mystical dreams.
Unity.
Yeah.
Okay. In that way.
A better connection with your environment.
The respect.
Well. Shit.
And an understanding that we give as much as we take.
Hashtag bring the medieval back.
Hashtag bring the medieval back. We're gonna get so fucked for that one. We're gonna get cancelled. So
nah,
fast.
Man, only if people don't understand what the medieval actually was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is why we're gonna get cancelled.
Oh, yeah, true. Yeah. Shit.
I think that's it. We don't need to bring the context. We can end it there. we can end there if that's okay.
Yeah.
How are you guys feeling? If you guys want to talk about that.
Feeling?
Yeah, just talking about this kind of... I know was it intimidating talking about like this kind of physicist or scientific thing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not qualified on so many levels
talk
about anything to do with this.
I want to start reading sci-fi, but I'm not there yet.
But just on so many levels.
Yeah.
Wait.
But, you know, it's my opinion, isn't it? Still got one. And we're here recording it, apparently.
I don't know if you were being ironic.
What?
About saying that you're not qualified.
We're not.
Well, I think we're not qualified.
We don't read sci-fi, and we're not physicists.
Right, but that's... I don't think we should think like that. Because the whole point of... Even Bose himself was like... I'm not being like...
Details.
Yeah, like we can't sit here and talk about what it means to be a Bengali scientist operating.
I mean.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think we can talk about... Bose himself believed in the unity of things, you know, which is like, for example, he was ousted for trying to unite physics and biology. And people are like, you can't do that. We're hyper-specialized now.
My great-grandfather was a biophysicist. He'd be raging over that.
There you go. But in that sense, I think the more we allow everybody to talk about these things, the more ways of existence there are, I think, in that sense. And that's why this conversation has been really nice. And I'm really glad we get to record it.
Yeah.
I
mean, no voices.
Yeah. Okay.
It's nice. It's nice to talk about it. And even if, like, I hear that there's bad reviews on YouTube and stuff like that on it. So at least it made us do all of this.
Uh-huh.
So at least it made us talk about it more.
Right.
It made all of us read it.
No press is bad press.
That's what they say.
A buzz is a buzz, whatever you do. So,
okay.
In the end, we all read it.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, it got attention. So, there's that. I'm at least happy for that.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Peace.
Peace.
Brought to you from a very expensive studio session.
Yeah.
So professional.
I am caught.